This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome again to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 15th episode. Today, we discuss another JCENM study, this one looking at the increasingly common challenge of hypoglycemia following gastric bypass surgery. The study design used will give us insight into potential limitations of the author's findings, so we'll do our usual close look at the inferential methods employed here. I have the distinct privilege of hosting this podcast. I work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, as a general endocrinologist, serving as the medical director for the outpatient clinics and as an associate director for our fellowship program. As our regular contributor today, we welcome back Marc-André Cornier from the University of Colorado, where he holds many leadership roles in their clinical enterprise. Importantly for our discussion today, Mark is an expert in both clinical care and research in obesity medicine, as well as an expert educator both at his institution and nationally with the Endocrine Society. Today, Marzia Salehi joined us as our guest expert. She hails from the University of Texas, San Antonio. She also has significant clinical and research expertise in obesity medicine, particularly in hypoglycemia following bariatric surgery. So as you can all see, I'm joined by the perfect pair of endocrinologists for our discussion today. As always, everything discussed today will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today, we review glycemic patterns are distinct in post-bariatric hypoglycemia after gastric bypass, which is an August edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. This report comes to us from the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard University in Boston with Daniel Lee as the first author. Mark, let's have you walk us through the author's introduction to highlight the main points that the authors make, but also for you and Marzia to help us understand the landscape in post-bariatric surgery hypoglycemia. Mark?
Thank you for the introductions. Pleasure to be back on one of these programs. So let's step back and take a look at the background on this paper. So we know that post-bariatric hypoglycemia after Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery is a serious and clinically challenging complication of this procedure. Classically, this is described as a postprandial problem, but I would like to get some input from Dr. Salehi on this.
Thanks very much for the introduction as well, and glad to be here. So this is a late complication of gastric bypass, as you mentioned, Mark, and a serious one. That means that if the symptoms start within 6 to 12 months from the surgery, then other causes of the hypoglycemia has to be worked out. And symptoms usually occur within 1 to 3 hours from meal ingestion. Generally, these are simple carbohydrate ingestion, and they are relieved by carbohydrate intake. So that means if the symptoms are occurring after 4 or 5 hours from meal ingestion in a post-absorptive state or fasting, definitely other causes to look into fasting component of hypoglycemia have to be evaluated. So a typical case to just start the whole discussion with is someone who had gastric bypass surgery and doing really well. They have lost a lot of weight. They came off of the medication. Everything is going really well. The majority of these patients, until they start noticing some symptoms, which it can be from palpitation, shakiness to sweating, which are mainly autonomic symptoms. And they don't even pay attention to these symptoms. They actually attribute these symptoms to so many other causes. And then these symptoms progress to neuroglycopenic symptoms, which range from somewhere from weakness, behavioral changes, to confusion, loss of consciousness, and seizure, which this is the part which generally witness by family members, co-worker, and they actually seek help by third party to address and treat hypoglycemia. This is very much serious because it can actually just lead to injury for the patient. That goes from fall, motorcycle accident to professional damages. I have had patients losing their job. So diagnosis, as you mentioned, Mark, is extremely challenging for both patients and physicians. The reason mainly is that you have to differentiate a true hypoglycemia in the prandial state from asymptomatic low glucose levels, which is really frequent after gastric bypass, as well as prandial symptoms of dumping syndrome, which again is very frequent after gastric bypass. So a snapshot of mechanism which can cause this syndrome is that what we know is there are many factors involved, but the root of the issue seems to be the changes in the glycemic excursion after eating, which happens because of the rerouted GI tract after gastric bypass. But we believe that the hypoglycemia is an extreme glycemic effect of gastric bypass. So it seems that the extent of glycemic excursion is spanning the continuum rather than a dichotomous pattern towards the hypoglycemia versus asymptomatic.
So Marzi, I might actually ask you a follow-up question then. So when you think about this, would you then view this, you said, just as a potential spectrum then? So that remission of diabetes that we so often see for these folks with hypoglycemia, it was maybe they just had a little bit too much of that. For everybody else whose diabetes went away and they did fine, that just seemed to be just the right amount. But for this smaller group, but still substantial amount of individuals, it's maybe just too much of a good thing, or is it an entirely different mechanism that's driving people to sometimes substantial hypoglycemia?
Yeah, it seems to be a combination of both. Yeah, absolutely. As you just mentioned, there is a dramatic glycemic improvement after gastric bypass, and that happens immediately after gastric bypass. So partly the glycemic improvement after gastric bypass is weight loss independent. And that weight loss independent glycemic of gastric bypass, to just talk about it a little bit briefly, to just understand how hypoglycemia can develop, is that in non-surgical patient, the prandial glucose metabolism is very much dependent on the pace of nutrient emptying from the stomach to the gut, as well as hepatic glucose uptake, as well as non-hepatic glucose uptake. And this nutrient emptying from the stomach pouch after gastric bypass seems to be 100 times higher, larger after gastric bypass. So we know that the glucose regulation is basically based on a balance between the total glucose appearance as well as the glucose utilization. And we believe we know that the gastric bypass reset the balance between the glucose appearance and glucose utilization. So in parallel with the very much higher, larger increase in appearance of ingested glucose into the circulation of the gastric bypass, we have observed and documented by multiple investigators that there is a hyperinsulinemia, there is an increased beta cell secretion after eating. And that is multifactorial as well. Part of it is because the gut hormones are being involved. And something like glucagon-like peptide 1, which is a very strong insulin secretagogue, is increased by tenfold after gastric bypass. So everything being said is being exaggerated in patients who develop hypoglycemia. These patients, they have much faster ingested glucose appearance into the circulation, as well as much higher insulin secretion, much higher GLP-1 secretion, as well as GLP-1 action. Blocking GLP-1 can correct hypoglycemia in every single patient with hypoglycemia. So it's the main core of pathogenic factors for this condition. Having said that, so this is actually all suggesting this is a too much of a good thing, perhaps. But at the same time, there are evidence suggesting that this dramatic prandial glucose metabolism changes after gastric bypass is associated with some sort of physiologic adaptation. So patients after gastric bypass, they do have a blunt beta cell response to increasing glucose, or GLP-1 infusion for that matter. So there is a lack of sensitivity of beta cell towards the insulin stimuli, the beta cell secretory stimuli. And that may be lacking in patients with hypoglycemia. So at the same time, they have too much of good things, but at the same time, they are lacking the adaptation which prevents hypoglycemia, majority of gastric bypass. Along the same line, in the glucose itself can actually just dictate the glucose uptake. This is something we call glucose effectiveness. So it's being shown, we have shown that the glucose effectiveness is decreased after gastric bypass, meaning that, again, another adaptation to prevent hypoglycemia in this population. But also, it has been shown that patients with hypoglycemia, they are lacking that. They have a higher glucose effectiveness compared to asymptomatic. So in summary, there is a combination of both, having more glycemic effect of gastric bypass appear in these patients, or perhaps susceptible patients, they are lacking some adaptive mechanism to protect them against hypoglycemia.
Thank you for that elaborate discussion. That was great. So one of the things that's also been looked at is that glycemic patterns after surgery and how that might relate again to this post-bariatric hypoglycemic syndrome using continuous glucose monitoring or CGM. What's been looked at in the past? Are there any studies out there that have looked at these patterns, and are there challenges with making a diagnosis of hypoglycemia using CGM?
The patterns are important in clinical care, but they are not really, there's not much of actually a role for diagnosis of hypoglycemia in general in non-diabetic patients, including those with gastric bypass. So the reason is that the diagnosis of hypoglycemia in general relies on having low glucose associated with symptoms and relief of symptoms immediately when the glucose is being corrected and normalized, something we call VPL triad. And this is really hard to establish using the CGMS. So apart from the glycemic pattern, in order to actually have some kind of actually a detailed evaluation and documentation of VPL triad, it's kind of actually very difficult using the CGMS. But to add to the complexity, what is the glycemic threshold, which is important to call something hypoglycemic? It comes basically from our understanding from studies which they use insulin to induce hypoglycemia in the fasting state. When they saw the decline of the glucose, the counter-regulatory response was increased, and they actually documented this is going to be glycemic threshold. But again, this was documented only in fasting state. So in prandial state, we have really no idea what that glycemic threshold is. So again, we know from multiple studies from 80s that the prandial state is very different from fasting. So one of the studies which look into challenging 650 patients, completely normal individual without any symptoms, with oral glucose tolerance test, and they reported 10% of individual non-diabetic, healthy individual, they develop nadir glucose level less than 47 milligram per deciliter. And 2.5% of this population, they develop actually glucose level under 37. And they entirely, they were asymptomatic before and during the test. So this kind of questions the value of glycemic threshold we are using in prandial state, adding to the challenges of making the diagnosis in hypoglycemia. So we expect, because of the rerouted gut and GI tract after gastric bypass, we expect that asymptomatic hypoglycemia to be higher. There is a higher frequency of asymptomatic hypoglycemia after gastric bypass. In fact, this has been reported over and over. In one of the good studies, they reported in about 40 or 50 patients, non-diabetic individual using continuous glucose monitoring, 70% of these individuals, they had at least one episode of hypoglycemia under 55. But when they actually used the symptom log, associated symptoms, they were lacking in 80% of those hypoglycemic chemical low glucose levels. So this kind of actually putting together, it seems that in population of gastric bypass, that we have such a high frequency of asymptomatic hypoglycemia, utilization of CGMS by itself, it's very tricky. But in addition to all being said, there is some limitation, technical limitation from using of CGMS to detect hypoglycemia. So it has been known that accuracy of CGMS to detect glucose in the lower range is inferior to glucose levels in the normal or even higher range. But on top of that, it's interesting that there are documentation in the literatures for supporting the CGMS sensor inaccuracy towards hypoglycemia readings, especially during nocturnal time. So this has been documented in lean patients, non-diabetic and diabetic patients. So imagine you have patients with gastric bypass, and after gastric bypass, they are left with a massive skin in the abdominal area. This inaccuracy of CGMS towards hypoglycemia is being attributed to the pressure effect. And the sleep position has something to do with it because the biomechanical pressure in the area of the sensor can change the blood flow as well as oxygen tension in the area. And both of them, they can depress the readings without a true hypoglycemia. And a drop of glucose towards the hypoglycemic range has been well documented because of their sleep position. And it can be assumed that in patients with a lot of actual skin mass around the abdomen, this would be a much more troublesome for the CGMS. So in summary, maybe actually I have to sum it up. The CGMS should be only used for evaluating the glycemic pattern as a way, as a tool for monitoring the effect of intervention. So at baseline and after the intervention. And mostly it has to be utilized in the daytime because the nocturnal numbers, until further studies actually showing the validation of nocturnal numbers, has to be interpreted with caution.
Let's come back to the concept of reactive hypoglycemia, because you described the classic study where people were asymptomatic and had blood glucoses in the 30s and 40s. Yet, as endocrinologists, we all see these patients that are referred for hypoglycemia that's postprandial and are often given the diagnosis of reactive hypoglycemia. So one, obviously there's controversy there whether that actually is a real condition or not, but post-bariatric hypoglycemia is often compared to that. So what are your thoughts on the comparison and also the controversy of the whole concept of reactive hypoglycemia?
Yeah, it's intriguing, isn't it? So the term was used really 4 or 5 decades ago for individuals who had postprandial symptoms from palpitation to sweating and anxiety, mainly autonomic symptoms. And they were actually in response to eating mainly high carbohydrate meals. And with dietary modification, they responded actually they had relief. So the diagnosis at the time was replicating their symptoms using the OGT and showing the chemical low glucose associated with the symptoms. So this became a hot topic literally 4 or 5 decades ago, investigated by many. And the findings by these studies made it clear that perhaps there's not so much clinical relevance for this term. So there was a study that they compare patients with and without reactive, so-called reactive hypoglycemia, using the oral glucose challenge test. And something about 25% of both groups, they develop actually nadir glucose level less than 50. So they had equal number of people who manifested the hypoglycemia, chemical hypoglycemia. Then they compare the glucose profile after meal ingestion in both groups. And now neither of groups, they develop hypoglycemia. But reactive hypoglycemic patients, they remain symptomatic. So clearly the glucose was not associated with the symptoms. There were studies that they actually used placebo, no calorie intake, and they could induce symptom in patients with reactive hypoglycemia. Further, they started actually looking into counter-regulatory response. So these are studies where these patients, they were studied during meal tolerance test. And during the decline of glucose, they had exactly similar counter-regulatory response compared to people who did not have symptoms. The EEG patterns were not different in patients who had reactive hypoglycemia and those who didn't. Therefore, altogether, these are suggesting that this is not a true hypoglycemia because there is a dissociation of glucose profile and the symptoms, as well as any other actually counter-regulatory response which can be involved in hypoglycemic situation. Therefore, the experts suggest that the term has to be switched to idiopathic postprandial syndrome. So the importance of this is, even though I don't believe there is a relationship or kind of actually linkage between the reactive, so-called reactive hypoglycemia or postprandial syndrome in non-surgical patient and hypoglycemia after gastric bypass, I believe that the dumping syndrome, which happens after gastric bypass up to 30%, might have some sort of similar route of pathologic pathways. So this is, again, in non-surgical patients, this postprandial syndrome is quite rare, but in gastric bypass is really common. And that, again, it kind of actually indicates how important it is to utilize the VPL trial, not use the oral glucose tolerance test, use the meal tolerance test, as well as going based on low glucose with symptoms and no symptoms when the glucose is normal.
All right, let's come back to the study that we're discussing today. The aim of the study was to characterize the glycemic patterns in patients with post-bariatric hypoglycemia due to Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and in patients with other forms of, quote, reactive hypoglycemia and who did not have GI surgery and compare them to healthy controls in patients with newly diagnosed prediabetes or type 2 diabetes. So I think I'll turn it over to Chase now, who will review the methods of the paper.
Great. Thanks, Mark and Marzi, for giving us a nice overview there, really of an in-depth understanding of this challenging condition. And then also pointing out, I think, really nicely why we need more information or we need more studies like this, just because it's not clear exactly what's going on, how we need to think about this, what we need to compare it to. So we'll take a deep dive into the methods here, understand what the authors did in this study, and then that'll help us understand how to interpret their findings. So first of all, I think the helpful thing to start with is, as much as possible, trying to compare it to some of the typical study designs that are out there. This is not a standard study design, or one is not utilized here, but the approach is somewhat similar to a cross-sectional study. Now, to describe what a classic cross-sectional study would be is when you take a population of individuals and you take a cross-section through that population and you compare them, usually based on an exposure, was a group exposed or not to something, and how frequently an outcome occurs in one group versus another. This is going to be a little bit different. We're going to go through it in details, but there's actually multiple populations. So the different groups that are looked at, again, it's not just one big population that's separated into subgroups based on exposure, but they're substantially different populations of patients. However, the thing that is in common is the cross-sectional type of analysis. So all this data is collected really just at a single point in time. And that sets it apart from cohort studies where individuals are followed over time. Cohort studies are a little bit better in the observational literature to establish cause and effect, because you can usually, if done correctly, you can make sure that an exposure predates an outcome. Cross-sectional studies, it's a little bit more difficult to do that because you're getting all the information at one time. So that'll be helpful to keep that in mind, because that is the type of analysis that the authors used here. So let's actually think about this here. So these different groups. So we'll start with the individuals that are of most interest, and those are the individuals at the Joslin Diabetes Center. So two groups that they had here, the bigger group that they had, 40 individuals who had Roux-en-Y gastric bypass with hypoglycemia afterwards. But then they had another 20 individuals in a group with reactive hypoglycemia. We'll come to these controls that they use later, but these are the two main groups that we're interested in this study. And so all of these individuals, these 60 individuals, were evaluated for other causes of hypoglycemia. And the authors state that they ruled out autonomous insulin secretion by evaluating both fasting glucose and insulin levels. So I was curious here, always, and I think this comes up, Mark described how challenging different types of patients can be in this situation when coming with hypoglycemia. Always in the back of our mind is insulinoma. It's a really rare condition, but even in individuals who've had gastric bypass, from that original case series that was described, there are insulinoma patients in there. So I think that's always on our mind, when, at least when we see these patients in clinic. So I would ask that question about these patients that we're seeing here and get Marzi and Mark's input on this. Is would we feel that a simple fasting glucose and insulin level, if that's normal, would we feel comfortable saying, yeah, there's definitely not insulinoma patients in there? Or do we say, that's an awfully rare condition, we probably weren't that worried about it anyway? What are you all's thoughts on there, Marzi? Maybe we'll start with you.
So I agree. I don't think actually this is going to just determine, is not going to be exclusion for insulinoma. And I just have nothing more to add to that.
Right. I think, though, if, you know, the probability, pretest probability is pretty low,
yeah,
it's probably sufficient. You know, certainly we do that in our clinics where we have low suspicion for insulinoma. We do a simple 18-hour fast in the office. And only if we have higher suspicion or someone with a true Whipple's triad, then bring them in for formal, you know, 72-hour fast testing.
Yeah, I like that description. So maybe not totally rule it out, but enough to where the likelihood of any substantial number, really any patients with insulinomas making into this group, is awfully unlikely. Good. I like that assessment. Okay, so moving on again with these individuals at the Joslin with hypoglycemia. So they were selected for inclusion in this analysis based on the availability of CGM data. And so this was all masked Dexcom G4 data. And what I would mention on here is you always have to think about, whenever you see patients that were included because of the availability of a certain type of data, you do have to ask yourself, why was that data available for those individuals in the first place? And because the reason you ask that is because it introduces the possibility of a selection bias. So there is a reason that data was available. It wasn't because those individuals were randomly enrolled in a study and that's why they had that data available. It was because there was something clinically that was driving the providers, the clinicians, to say, we need this information. And because of that, so then you've got a select group of individuals. This isn't representative of a population at large that might show up with, say, symptoms, maybe occasional blood glucose on a random chemistry level that was low. But these are individuals that there is something that's driving providers to say, we need CGM data. And then once that CGM data was available, that's what then made these individuals available for this study. So we'll come back to this later and think about how this could impact this select group here because of the possibility of a selection bias. And the other thing that we need to think about is how individuals were placed into these groups. And so it was based on diagnoses that were within the electronic health record. And so several times already, the idea of Whipple's triad has come up, and that's a fairly rigorous, the standard definition for hypoglycemia, and that possibly that's how a diagnosis in an electronic health record would be used to label somebody with hypoglycemia, but possibly not always. Marzia walked us through the historic description of where reactive hypoglycemia came from. That's decades old. I certainly often see patients in clinic who have been labeled as reactive hypoglycemia, and they've never had any sort of a biochemical assessment. It was just because somebody told them that they probably had low blood sugars after they ate. So how comfortable are we with this, this main inclusion criteria being based on a diagnosis within an EHR without a clear mention of a Whipple's triad? So Mark, how about we start with you on this one and go to Marzi after that?
The diagnosis coming, simply from EHR certainly poses a number of problems and questions about the study and who's selected. How are these patients labeled, as you discussed? To me, that's a challenge. Did they really find the right patients? And potentially, this relates to the sample size that they have here, because certainly I'm guessing that they have many more patients who might have fulfilled their criteria. So I think without a standard diagnosing, I think that is a major limitation.
Marzi, what are your thoughts? You'd mentioned Whipple's triad. Give us some insight onto your thoughts about how this
work. For both groups of reactive hypoglycemia and gastric bypass related hypoglycemia, prandial state matters, and there's no way that they have any documentation in terms of where and when and how they documented hypoglycemia based on the EHR. We find this very difficult. So I have just did analysis on my EHR to just look for hypoglycemic patient, and I found like 400 being diagnosed with hypoglycemia. When you dig into the story, they are not truly hypoglycemia. So that makes it a major challenge. Yeah,
I agree. And I think to some degree, because I think Mark pointed out, well, potentially you've got way more than this. And I suspect, particularly this being at a great clinical place like the Joslin, is that there probably is relatively narrow group there. And it's probably not all comers within there that they're looking at. Again, to some degree, that selection bias, it had to be enough for providers after they've evaluated these individuals to say, I'm worried enough here that I need more information. I need to get a CGM. So in this case, that selection bias may be helpful and really helping to identify people who are truly having at least low blood sugars, depending on how you would describe that. Okay, so to wrap up this section here, for the individuals who had the gastric bypass and had hypoglycemia afterwards, most of those, 25 of those individuals, their data actually came from clinical trials. So to get into those clinical trials, it was fairly typical in that there were numerous exclusion criteria, but all relatively straightforward. So we won't go through the details of that. Now, there was another group of individuals that served as a comparison group, a control group. And these individuals, their data was from publicly available sources. And so there were several groups here. There were several individuals who were normal weight, healthy controls. There were several individuals who had newly diagnosed prediabetes after this data was obtained. And as a third subgroup here, there was a group with newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes, again, after CGM data was obtained in a similar fashion, this mass Dexcom G4. And as the authors point out, we'll take a look at this in a little bit more detail in the discussion section, but the authors point out there are different groups here. These populations are different. So there could be some issues with having different populations and comparing them, some things that may not be recognized. So we will certainly need to keep that in mind as we look through those results here shortly. But as far as thinking about other comparison groups that would be helpful to understand these two main groups that we're looking at, I know, Marzi, whenever you were helping us prepare for this, you had some thoughts about another potential group that would be helpful. And that's actually specifically seeing what information might look like if we had it from individuals who've had a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, but do not have known hypoglycemia as a consequence of that. So why don't you elaborate on that a little bit more for us?
So the part which actually the interpretation of the glycemic profile using the CGMS in patients with hypoglycemia does not really actually inform us in any way about the unique feature of hypoglycemia unless this is being correlated and compared with patients who did not have hypoglycemia. Because as I mentioned, rerouted GI tract increases the glycemic excursion. So whatever is being reported as increased variability and more actually frequency of lows or highs, they all can be the pattern of gastric bypass, simply changing this glycemic excursion after eating. So none of those can be interpreted to be unique for hypoglycemia unless this is being compared with patients who did not have hypoglycemia.
And so a few words on definitions that were used here. So definitions that were fairly standard, but I think we also need to think about where they come from and what impact that would have. So first of all, a couple of things to think about would be a hypoglycemic event and a hypoglycemic episode. So a hypoglycemic event would be if you just had a glucose. So it would be mild if it was below 70 milligrams per deciliter, and it would be severe if it was 54. Those are the two cutoffs that were used there. And then for it to actually be an episode, you have to have three consecutive values that showed up on the Dexcom. So this would be a prolonged period of time of glucose levels that are below these cutoffs. So again, 70 for mild, 54 for severe. And one thing that I want us to think about as a group, Marzi, you've kind of already mentioned this idea of we've got to be careful from taking cutoffs and equipment and techniques that are used in individuals with diabetes, and then just automatically applying those to individuals with other conditions in this situation, post-gastric bypass hypoglycemia. So elaborate about that a little bit more about using those cutoffs, particularly not just diabetes, but typically insulin-treated diabetes, that we would use those concerns for hypoglycemia. What worries might you have about using those cutoffs in this group?
So again, as mentioned before, changing the gastric bypass anatomical changes, it just kind of actually just reset the way the glucose profile response to eating is. So what is normal after eating? What is the peak normal glucose levels after gastric bypass? You cannot really actually pick someone without gastric bypass and use that norm and apply to these individuals. We do have actually, we have done a large group of patients with gastric bypass, asymptomatic and hypoglycemia. The peak of glucose is almost identical in patients who didn't have symptoms and people who have hypoglycemia. So that not necessarily is indicating abnormality related to hypoglycemia. Therefore, I do not believe any of non-surgical metrics and range has to be used to just call it as a norm range for after gastric bypass. That would not be appropriate.
Yeah, and I think that helps illustrate, to go back before talking about the idea of a selection bias, is that probably the reason these individuals had the CGM done in the first place is because they were symptomatic. And we don't know that for sure, but I think that would be a reasonable guess if you thought through clinical care. Well, what sort of people are you going to want CGMs on? It's those individuals who are having symptoms of hypoglycemia. That's why you look at it in the first place. So probably we have selected a group here who has symptomatic hypoglycemia, or at least has it to some degree, which prompted this data being obtained in the first place.
That's probably why they don't have a post-bariatric surgery non-hypoglycemic group, because there would not have been a reason to get CGMs on those patients. And so this, you know, again, suggests that this was a convenient sample overall.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. And I think, and authors do point out, this is a retrospective analysis. And I do think that nicely illustrates, when you're doing a retrospective analysis, one of the intrinsic weaknesses, again, nothing wrong that the authors did here, but an intrinsic weakness is you've got whatever data is available. You, prospective studies, you can decide what you want to get and then go get it. With retrospective, you're stuck with whatever you've got. And you have to do your analysis dealing with that. All right, and then just finally, so with the cutoffs with the CGM, low readings with the Dexcom 40 was the cutoff, was the lowest that could be reported. And so if it was reported as low, so lower than that, it was just always recorded as 40. But the authors point out, don't actually know how low it was, so that may not adequately represent how low the glucose has got in that situation. All right, so there's an overview of the methods. Mark, I'm going to turn it back over to you to walk us through the results, and we'll think through those.
Thank you, Chase. Well, let's start with general demographics. You know, who are these people? And if we turn to table one in the paper, we see that this is a group that's enriched in women compared to men or males across the board in all the groups. The pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes patients were older than the other groups. And the healthy controls, by definition, had a lower BMI, especially in comparison to the post-bariatric surgery individuals. And again, in table one, we look at the mean and the median sensor glucoses were similar when you look at the post-bariatric hypoglycemic individuals as compared to the healthy controls. But the peak glucose was significantly higher, and the nadir glucose was significantly lower in the post-bariatric hypoglycemic patients. Glucose variability was also higher in the post-bariatric hypoglycemic patients as compared to the healthy controls. One other factor that we see in table one that may be important, again, I will ask Salehe what she thinks of this, that the CGM duration was significantly less for the post-bariatric hypoglycemic patients as compared to the others, and curious as to why that might have been. Do you have thoughts on that?
So I think majority of these patients, they were pulled from a clinical trial, and that may be actually a limiting factor for the number of days that they were under study. But they had almost about 4 days of readings, which should be pretty good in terms of pointing out the major changes in the metrics, in my opinion.
Now, if we look at the figure 1A, we can see kind of the patterns of glucose and percent of time spent at any given level of glycemia. And we see that the range of glucose was actually higher in the post-bariatric hypoglycemic patients, which are seen in the red bars in figure 1A. And there seems to be a leftward shift as compared to the control and the type 2 patients. If you compare in figure 1B to the non-surgical hypoglycemic patients, there the curves and the range look very similar between the two hypoglycemic groups, both of them being somewhat leftward shifted compared to the control groups. Do either of you, Marzi or Chase, have any comments on these figures?
What I see here for, again, gastric bypass is a very typical expected picture that they do have a higher glycemic excursion. Therefore, they have a lower nadir level. They have a higher peak being shifted to the lower sign. But then in non-surgical hypo, we just discuss about who are these guys. What's the definition of, you know, having called them non. So I don't know if this is a normal actually set point for a group of normal individual without diabetes or not. It's part of the selection bias or not.
Well, if we then turn to the Table 2, which looks at the percent distribution of sensor glucose values over the 24 hours, so the full day, but also looking at just, quote, nighttime, so from 12 a.m. to 6 a.m. What we see here is that the percentage of time in range was lowest in the post-bariatric hypoglycemic participants, which was even greater at night when you look specifically during those nighttime hours. If you look at the time in the hypoglycemic range, so less than 70, we see that the two hypoglycemic groups are higher than the healthy controls and the pre-diabetes and diabetes individuals, and that we see that this holds true during the night, which obviously we typically think of this disorder as being a postprandial issue, yet we're seeing greater time spent in the hypoglycemic range during the nighttime hours. Any thoughts or comments on that?
So in my opinion, the study is not designed to really comment on nocturnal versus fasting, because in our experience, I mean, we all deal with these patients like so-called reactive hypoglycemia. They intend to have a late night snack intake. And majority of my patients with post-gastric bypass hypoglycemia, they always go for a snack at bedtime. So all of those lack of knowledge about the meal pattern in these individuals, they just chose the arbitrary daytime and nighttime is a major actually problem and limitation for interpreting anything. So that low numbers could be a postprandial setting for a late night snack rather than a nocturnal pattern for control patients. I caution the interpretation more than that.
Yeah, I think Marzi's comments are certainly appreciated there. And I would say it would be interesting if you had a little bit more information there and you could say, well, we know that they didn't. They took a food diary. We know they did need it at night. Because one thing that it would actually do that it would be really helpful having that overnight data is it might actually lessen the impact of what's described as a performance bias. Which is invariably, if you have an individual who's in a study and they know that they're in a study, for some reason, it's going to change their behavior. Because if you say, hey, we're in a study looking to see if what your blood sugars do after you eat, that's almost always going to affect how those individuals think about how they eat and when they eat. And so that could be something is that if there was a prolonged period where they weren't eating, so again, overnight, if you could confirm that that was the case, that could lessen the impact of performance bias and let you just see a little bit more of the pure biology and less exactly what's happening because of food intake there. But yeah, like I said, Marzi's point's a good one there is we don't know for sure how much of that time period is truly in a fasting state if they do eat late at night or potentially even in the middle of the night to avoid hypoglycemia.
Now we turn to the results on hypoglycemic episodes. As a reminder, this is at least three blood glucose, sensor data of under 70. Again, looking at this over 24 hours and then again at not quote night between 12 a.m. and 6 a.m. And what you can see in table three is that there were more episodes of hypoglycemia in a greater duration in the individuals with post-bariatric hypoglycemia, and that this actually also carried over to a similar pattern at nighttime, where we saw greater episodes and of greater duration. So somewhat consistent with the previous data. If we then turn to the figure two, we're looking at the mean hourly glucoses by the time of day for each of the different groups. And what we see is that the glycemic excursions, so if we look at the in red, the post-bariatric hypoglycemic individuals, that they had greater excursions throughout the day and also had the lowest mean glucose values during the night. I mean, I think you can also see the significant variability in the patients with type 2 diabetes as well, but overall greater excursions through the day and through the night in those with post-bariatric hypoglycemia. Any comments?
So again, I have some issues in terms of the method. The significant drop, the decline in glucose in figure two in patients with gastric bypass could be just really reflecting meal ingestion right before. And at the same time, we discuss about the sensor inaccuracy in terms of detecting hypoglycemia while there's no true hypoglycemia because of the pressure effect. We really have no idea about the sleep pattern among the groups. All we have is a BMI and age compatibility among the groups. But what other actually conditions they have, which actually creates changes in the sleep pattern, for example, and changes the way actually the CGMS and the pressure effect and all the other factors are playing is not known. So I do not think that this method is able to detect low glucose. So I cannot actually call this a low glucose at night. And by the way, they did not detect any low glucose under 54, which is a VPL triad, at night in any of the groups. So there was no hypoglycemia chemically being found. It's just a trend of lower glucose, which can be actually attributed to so many factors beyond just a glucose drop, a true glucose drop.
The authors then share the results, specifically looking at the non-surgical hypoglycemic individuals, and discuss that this was not associated with a difference in mean, median, peak, or nadir glucose compared to the healthy controls. Again, questioning the diagnosis of this non-surgical hypoglycemia and or quote reactive hypoglycemia. And you see in the figure two is that the non-surgical hypoglycemic patients had more quote lower blood glucose, low glycemia. But again, is this really hypoglycemia? These levels appear to be in the normal range if you look at the numbers here as was discussed. So I think this gets back again, perhaps at the impact of selection bias in these patients and Chase, do you have any further thoughts on that one?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think some of those differences could be that's what prompted the CGM data to be obtained in the first place, because these are folks, if you think about just a normal distribution in the population at large, and maybe if you want to suppose that maybe reactive hypoglycemia is not truly a pathologic condition, but you're just actually selecting some of those individuals that you have found who are on one of those tail ends that have lower normal blood glucoses, that could explain a lot of that. But by and large, just like you said, Mark, when you compare those individuals, there's really no difference in healthy controls and the reactive hypoglycemia as far as mean or median or peak or nadir glucoses. They're all exactly the same. So I think that at least does call into question if there's any true pathophysiology here, or if it's just individuals who have symptoms and we happen to be finding those who have symptoms and then also have some sugar, some glucoses that are on the lower end of normal, and we're labeling those individuals as reactive hypoglycemia.
And also, I have one more comment on the figure two. So if the mean, median, and all the markers are absolutely the same, and during the day, at least for a large part, the non-surgical hypos seem to be exactly the same as controls, why we have such a big deviation at night? And that, to me, has to actually have some reflection on the mean and median, and it's not, doesn't have it. So is it because of few patients, they are pulling that one to the lower level for whatever reason? I just don't know. The figure is not clear enough for me to understand if this represents all of the patient, or is just because this is the average being pulled and there are outliers in the cohort.
Right. And they actually make the comment that the patterns are similar between the two hypoglycemic groups. But the reality, the patterns are similar to the controls as well. If anything, yeah, there's a little more variability with the post-bariatric. But if anything, they have higher blood glucoses, not lower, which is also important to note. But perhaps, you know, there's that whole concept of relative hypoglycemia and whether the delta, you know, the change in glucose, is that important? And I know that brings up another whole can of worms and discussion.
It's actually well recognized that you do have a normal individual non-diabetic, you do have a decline, a slight decline of glycemia throughout the nocturnal period. And that being attributed to lower hepatic glucose output, as well as the brain glucose uptake. So somehow, the basal hepatic glucose output that we always measure at 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. is not really the nadir. The nadir happens in 3 or 4 a.m. But I really do not think that the numbers here are representing anything deviation from the normal, because the method doesn't allow us to see it that way.
Good. So thanks, Marzi, because that's actually a really good segue there into thinking about the discussions here as the authors outline them. So let's start with that. So, well, first of all, we'll start with the author's conclusions. And the first big one that they do point out that there is greater glycemic variability in patients who have had gastric bypass with the hypoglycemia than in these other groups. And so their first big point that they make about that is just what Mark just pointed out, is that highs drive a big part of that. There are also more lows during the day and night, again, with some limitations that Marzi outlined for us with that, but there is a greater variability there. And just as far as a mechanism go that the authors speculate on here, just like Marzi walked us through before, that the daytime variability is likely due to the rapid gastric emptying followed by increased insulin release driven by GLP-1. The nighttime, though, is as they speculate on that, what could be causing that, they outline several possible mechanisms there that I wanted us to think about, because I thought several of those were interesting. So they say potentially the nighttime lows that the post-surgical folks are experiencing may be from delayed effects of postprandial insulin secretion. So Marzi outlined that, particularly if you're eating late at night, that could easily drive that. I think that would make a lot of sense. Other possibilities, though, reductions in glycogenolysis would be one possibility, failure of transition to gluconeogenesis, or potentially even another one, insulin-independent glucose uptake. So Marzi, some of those other three, we didn't really talk about those as possibilities. Again, the authors are just speculating. They're not concluding anything there. But what are your thoughts on their speculations as to how likely any of those other mechanisms might be at play?
So I mean, again, if this was a true decline in glucose without any other factors, all of those the speculations, they could have been hypotheses to just go after. At this point, I don't know if this is a decline in glucose, but regarding the insulin-dependent glucose uptake, so as we just discussed, that is being actually just recognized that patients in gastric bypass in general, they have a lower insulin-dependent glucose uptake, but in patients with hypoglycemia, they have lack of that adaptation somehow. But that should not really vary from daytime to nighttime. So I would not think that would be a factor which contribute to the decline in glucose. But then if there is any deviation from normal, definitely hepatic glucose output, lack of actually all of the factors they speculated here could be the factors.
Right. And another big point that the authors make here is they point out that with reactive hypoglycemia, those individuals who carry that diagnosis only had significantly lower glucoses at night. So now when we think of reactive hypoglycemia, we think of that as exclusively a postprandial phenomena. They weren't lower postprandially. And we've batted that around a bit already. But I do think that at least calls into questions that this idea is there really pathophysiology that's going on, at least as far as what the glucoses do, when in this study, they didn't see any differences there. So one other comment by the authors that I think is helpful and really is relevant to other things that we've discussed is when they look at healthy controls and looking at that hypoglycemia. So if you're using a cutoff of under 70 as hypoglycemia, and the authors here describe that as mild hypoglycemia, is that healthy controls were under that cutoff 3.2% of the time. So that was not an uncommon occurrence for individuals who had no known reason to have hypoglycemia. Much less common if you use the cutoff of 54, so the more severe hypoglycemia. So that was 0.2% of the time. So not very frequent there, but mild, yes, that happened quite a bit. And other things to think about for us. So the authors, I think, do a really good job of outlining many of the limitations that are in their study. I mentioned this before, retrospective analyses, the way that those are set up, just almost always they have substantial limitations. There's really no way to get around that. One thing that's important, though, is that authors recognize that they point those out, that they understand those limitations. And I do think the authors have done a good job here. So several of the items that they mention. So they said, when you're looking at this, we really just looked at one type of gastric surgery. So the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass in particular, that was the only one that we looked at. Retrospective data, we've talked about that. It was unknown if the lows were symptomatic. So they had the glucose data, the objective data, but they didn't have any subjective data to go along with that. They didn't have an idea of the true magnitude of those lows that were described as under 40, just because that sensor couldn't detect that low at all. When we talk about the differences in the study groups, particularly that publicly available data for the healthy controls or those just recently diagnosed with prediabetes or diabetes, that could be differences in demographics there that would have an impact that's unrecognized in interpreting the results here. Actually, another thing that they point out is that those individuals who had the CGM data from the gastric bypass hypoglycemia, that they used their CGM a little bit less. So it's possible that could have an impact, though unknown. Food intake could be different, as could the timing of meals, because we don't have that information. Marzi pointed out how important that would be already, and the authors agree that those are potential limitations there. Another thing that we didn't discuss, but the authors do a good job of mentioning, is that activity. We don't really have any information on that. That was not recorded, so we don't understand the potential impact there. Only other thing that I would potentially add on top of that, we've talked about some of these other biases, but potentially selection bias, really with reactive hypoglycemia, though I think also the gastric bypass folks could have an impact there. So where I want us to end is with the authors. They have a nice section of their implications for practice. So they say, this is the data that we came up with. Yep, it's got a lot of limitations, but it's an important group of subjects that we need to understand more. So what can we take out of what information we have here? And a couple of things that they said is that one, that we really need to be looking at nocturnal hypoglycemia. That needs a little bit closer attention. And the other thing that they point out is that the nocturnal hypoglycemia may not have the same physiology as fasting hypoglycemia. We've talked about this a lot, but I want us to think about those things as we wrap up here and discuss overall, will this change our practice? So Mark and Marzi, why don't you give us your thoughts on just this study overall, what you think it adds to the body of evidence that's out there in hypoglycemia, particularly after gastric bypass surgery?
So lack of asymptomatic patients after gastric bypass, lack of meal and a sleep pattern in the study, it really, really limits their interpretation of the data in a sense that this definitely needs the next step to go and look at all those elements in a better design study. However, I think it's really premature to take the data and imply that we need to start looking at nocturnal hypoglycemia, such as headaches in the morning or sweating at night. Having symptoms after gastric bypass creates a lot of paranoia in the population. So we don't want to add to it by not having, based on no evidence. And I do not see the data as evidence to change the practice and start looking at nocturnal hypoglycemia. And also, again, we have to reiterate that they did not find any hypoglycemia. It was just lower blood glucose levels without any symptoms. So based on the data and the design, I do not believe that right now it's just the time to change the practice based on the data. We need more studies, more data.
Well, I think that the average is not necessarily mean hypoglycemic, but some of these individuals did have blood glucoses in the, you know, less than 70. And so by their definitions of episodes individually. So at night, which I think was a little surprising to me, I think one of the questions is, you know, if you have a post-bariatric patient who has symptoms of hypoglycemia, but they're more fasting, do we need to be less concerned about insulinoma in those patients and that this might just be part of their syndrome? Is this something that this has made me think a little bit more about? I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Or say, Mark, I would actually chime in here and say, just because, you know, with all the limitations, Marzi's points are well taken. I think they're really good. Is that I do think it is interesting because I have had several patients, as I think reflecting on my own clinical practice, who, you know, accuracy issues certainly included there, would at least appear to have hypoglycemia overnight. And that would always, what could flummox me quite a bit, make me worried, oh, have I missed something? Had they had an insulinoma for years that everybody's missed? And at least this raises the possibility of, well, maybe there just could be something else here. We don't maybe truly understand the pathophysiology here. So I agree. We have a lot of limitations and questions that we would have to get answered here, but could just be a natural pattern that we see here. And I don't think it necessarily means we have to be worried about some other condition that we've missed this whole time. But yeah, Marcy, why don't you follow up with your thoughts on that? And then in particular, maybe we can put you on the spot as you'd say, well, if we needed further investigation, certainly the authors have called for further investigation. How might we go about doing that in this population? It could be challenging to study, particularly trying to investigate overnight hypoglycemia if CGM may not be as accurate as we'd like it to be. So we'll finish things with your thoughts on those areas.
So I would say that the threshold of glucose under 70 to me is not a hypoglycemia mild or whatever else they call it in this population or in non-diabetic population. So first I would go with the threshold, which is really actually at least based on the classical understanding of hypoglycemia, which can provoke response, physiologic response. And I think actually in a control setting, if the CGMS is being utilized in a control setting, meaning that you do have a very detailed log about the sleep pattern and meal pattern, I think that would be the key to discern what is the nocturnal and the daytime effect. And I would actually just go beyond that. And I would say it would be really interesting to use multiple sensors at the same time in one individual and understand that if the location based on their anatomical changes and the skin mass, it has anything to do with the glucose readings when you're actually just using CGMS, even actually if you're just detecting the chemical hypoglycemia. But I think in that sense, you're gonna actually obtain a lot of information which is missing in this paper.
And with that, I would like to thank Marc-André Cournier and Marzi Salehi for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.